Chapter 11. Analyzing. The Sutta. Again, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu abides contemplating mind objects as mind objects in terms of the five aggregates affected by clinging. And how does a bhikkhu abide contemplating mind objects as mind objects in terms of the five aggregates affected by clinging? Here, a bhikkhu understands such is material form, such its origin, such its disappearance. Such is feeling, such its origin, such its disappearance. Such is perception, such its origin, such its disappearance. Such are the formations, such their origin, such their disappearance. Such is consciousness, such its origin, such its disappearance. The traditional phrase, "thus have I heard," with which the Satipatthana Sutta opens, tells us that this is one of the discourses that the Buddha's companion Ananda is said to have recalled from memory at the first council, in other words, the first gathering of monks after the master's passing away. Ananda stands at the beginning of a long tradition of teaching and translation of the Buddha's message, which now spans some thousands of years. Yet, despite the increasing availability of texts from all parts of the Buddha's tradition, the fact remains that the Buddha himself committed nothing to writing. He gave discourses and engaged in dialogue with many people, but it was his disciples who passed down to succeeding generations what they had heard and understood. And this, of course, meant memorizing it all. The first council was the first major step towards addressing the problem of how to maintain the authentic teachings once the Buddha had passed away, a problem which was to become a major preoccupation for the Buddhist community as the tradition grew and spread. For several hundred years, the energies of the Buddha's followers went into simply preserving the teachings as they had been handed down by the oral tradition. And this is why the Pali Suttas appear so formulaic and repetitive to the modern reader. They were not intended to be read at all. The idea was to lodge them in the mind through oral recitation. Originally, the word schemes of the Pali Canon were regarded as supports for meditation, helping the practitioner to make the fact of, say, impermanence more real by reciting a list. Feelings are impermanent, perceptions are impermanent, and so on. A more abstract or general statement might wash over the mind, but this breakdown into specific detail gives a variety within the steady repetition of a constant pattern, and the idea is thus hammered home. This technique was not the invention of those who began the tradition of recitation and memorization. It goes back to the Buddha himself and to his identification of what are called in Pali the five khandhas, in Sanskrit skandhas. From the very beginning, he urged his followers to recognize the impermanent and conditioned nature of existence. But it is very difficult to acknowledge this fully. Powerful measures are needed to help one break through one's resistance to the hard reality behind this simple idea. As we have seen, one way is to seize the opportunity of those times when the fact of impermanence is painfully impressed upon us by circumstances. But even such sharp reminders are dulled by the passage of time. One has to find a way of keeping one's awareness fresh and alive. Clearly, just saying to oneself that all things are impermanent, even repeating it over and over again, is not going to do that. But one can take it further by breaking one's experience of things down into its constituent parts and considering that each and every part is not fixed but ever-changing. Thus, the apparent solidity of things is revealed as illusory, and even the very idea of personal existence, the notion of a self or soul which is somehow impervious to change, is challenged. Reflection on the five khandhas shows that one's experience, and indeed one's self, is complex and fluid, never for an instant to be thought of in terms of fixed identity. It is no doubt because of the power of these reflections to change one's perception of existence that the khandhas are one of the most frequently cited classifications in the whole of Buddhist literature, both in the texts of the Pali Canon and in centrally important Mahayana scriptures such as the Heart Sutra. The term khanda, translated here as aggregate, is often translated simply as heap, and according to the Buddhist analysis, everything in existence can be understood to be composed of a collection of these heaps, inextricably mixed together. The word heap, though, suggestive as it is of something concrete and substantial, does not capture the ever-changing nature of the five khandhas. Form, or rupa, feeling, or vedana, recognition, sanya, volition or formations, sankhara, and consciousness, vijnana. In the normal course of things, we experience the khandhas all together, as one big heap, one might say. But for the purposes of this practice, which is meant to help us break the chain that seems to hold them together, and thus prevents us from seeing that our experience is composite, we are given the challenge of contemplating them as separate items in a systematic way. They have already been considered as objects of mindfulness, mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of feelings, and so on. Now you reflect on their very nature. You start by becoming aware of your physical body as rupa, or material form, which, as we have seen, stands for the objective content of the perceptual situation. It is what we seem to come up against in our basic relationship with the world. The exercise involves being mindful primarily of sense contact, noticing the particular qualities of things before you have started identifying what they represent to you or having feelings about them. You just watch them arise and pass away. With the arising of vedana, or feeling, the second of the khandhas, this awareness of stimulus is coloured by some kind of attitude towards it, a response of pleasure or pain emanating from within our own consciousness. We either like or dislike or remain unaffected by the stimulus, and this leads us into acting, even if only mentally or emotionally, in some way in relation to the object. However, in the context of reflecting on the khandhas, you are mindful primarily of the feelings in your experience, and if you can manage not to get carried away by thoughts and desires based on those feelings, you can note how they arise and how they disappear. Our response to those feelings involves perception, or sanya, the third khanda, which is a sense of recognition of the perceptual situation and its basic meaning for us. So the third stage of the practice is to be mindful of your perceptual activity as far as you can, being conscious of a world of objects which you can identify, and seeing that one perception gives way to another. This is quite a delicate operation, as it must be carried out at the very point at which the fourth khanda, volitions or sankhara, comes into play, as the desire arises for a particular kind of new experience towards which we direct our action. So the fourth aspect of the practice is to be mindful of these volitions, observing impulses, drives, acts of will, whether of attraction or repulsion, as they arise and disappear. This is perhaps the most crucial part of the practice, concerning, as it does, the very workings of karma. These volitions will generally produce effects of some kind in the future, particularly in terms of creating habits, whether positive or negative. However, in this specific practice, the task is not to try to do something different, but simply to be mindful of those volitions, to note how they come into being and pass away. Lastly, one is aware also of being conscious of the whole process. This is vijnana, consciousness itself. So in the final stage of the practice, you try, and again, this is something of a challenge, to to be mindful of your own consciousness, to be aware of the space, so to speak, in which objects of consciousness arise. The Sutta. In this way, he abides contemplating mind objects as mind objects, internally, externally, and both internally and externally. And he abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. That is how a bhikkhu abides contemplating mind objects as mind objects, in terms of the five aggregates affected by clinging. As in the other sections, the sutta exhorts us to contemplate the khandhas externally as well as internally, a reminder of the other regarding perspective that we always need in order to counterbalance what is inherently internal or self-regarding about the practice. We can also apply the principle of conditionality to the practice, contemplating arising and vanishing factors in mind objects. And we can keep reminding ourselves of our ultimate goal so that we don't get caught up in worldly or limited aims. This last perspective seems especially relevant to the five khandhas, at least historically speaking, because it is quite easy to see how limitations in relation to them did begin to arise within the tradition. Contemplating the khandhas encourages one to see one's personal experience in dynamic terms, as a complex of interrelated processes rather than a fixed entity, or even an entity made up of a collection of smaller entities such as organs or substances. The keynote of the whole formulation is impermanence. But of course it is human nature to try to pin things down, and this applies to the khandhas themselves. We might start to think of them as fixed entities. To guard against this, the tradition further subdivided these components of the self into smaller fragments still. Rupa, for example, was broken down into 28 subcategories, the first of which were the four material elements, which were themselves classified into subjective and objective aspects. Indeed, the more you look at this complex system, the more complex it becomes. And there's the rub. Although this method of classification was specifically set up as a means of understanding individual existence as the product of conditions, the very development of a procedure to reduce everything to constituent subsidiary processes seemed to imply that in the end you could arrive at a finite number of ultimate elements of existence. Over time, under the influence of scholastic elements within the Buddhist tradition, particularly in the Theravadin and Sarvastivadin schools, there emerged a tendency to reify the elements or dhammas into which the khandhas were subdivided as really existent things in themselves. We should not underestimate the subtlety with which the early schools of Buddhism sought to understand the mystery of impermanence. These schools were not talking about dhammas as if they were the objective constituents of the universe, like the atoms of Democritus or the periodic table of 20th century chemistry. Nonetheless, they did show a tendency to treat dhammas as ultimate, even without creating an actual philosophical theory of their ultimacy. The mind, it seems, can cope with certainties, even irrelevant certainties, much more easily than with incommunicable truths. When some members of the dominant school in India in the early period of Buddhist history, the Sarvastivadins, stated explicitly that dhammas were ultimate, it was realized by the people whom we might call the earliest Mahayana Buddhists that it had become necessary to reaffirm the Buddha's original teaching. The question was how to get back to the original point that the five khandhas were meant to illustrate. Among all the early schools, there was general agreement that while questions regarding the path were of utmost importance, more speculative questions and philosophical views did not affect one's progress to enlightenment. But the Mahayanists took the view that the reification of dhammas, that is, the view that the constituents of existence had some unchanging reality, limited the level of one's insight to that of Pudgala Nairatmya, or no self in the person. Progress to the realization of Dharma Nairatmya, or no self in the Dhammas, would occur only when that wrong view was abandoned. Not that the Savastivadins would have agreed that what they were doing was reifying Dhammas, but clearly the Mahayanists felt that the point had to be made. Before we look at the Mahayana perspective on the five khandhas, it is worth reminding ourselves of the history of that perspective. Clearly it differs in some ways from the recension of the Buddha's teachings found in the Pali canon, but we need not assume that what we think of as Mahayana was therefore a later development. Indeed, it is evident that Mahayana-type views had their antecedents very early in Buddhist history. The Pali scriptures cannot be regarded as the only version of the Buddha's original dispensation, handed down exactly as received from the enlightened master himself. For one thing, the form in which the Pali canon has come down to us clearly owes much to succeeding generations of recorders of the oral tradition. In order to evaluate or even understand the Pali canon, we must view it as a collection of disparate texts with different histories. But also, it is pure chance that it is this version of the teachings that was written down and preserved. It seems that, from very early on, the Dharma found expression in a great diversity of schools. One gets the impression that the Buddha's teaching was many-sided to begin with, and that quite soon after the Buddha passed away, a whole spectrum of schools emerged, interpreting and presenting different facets of the original dispensation. These traditions grew up gradually in an organic way and continued to flourish side by side, at least until the reign of the Emperor Ashoka in the 3rd century BCE. Ashoka's accession to power was perhaps the most significant influence on the growth of Buddhism in India. A convert to Buddhism himself, one of his decrees was that messengers of the Dharma should go out into the world beyond the imperial frontiers. According to Sinhalese tradition, it was Ashoka's son Mahinda who took the Buddha's teachings to Sri Lanka in oral form, and it was there that the teachings were eventually committed to writing shortly before the beginning of the Common Era. With the Muslim invasions of mainland India in the 11th and 12th centuries, an extensive Buddhist culture that had prospered for some 16 centuries was wiped out within a few short years, and Buddhism in India died out almost completely. No Pali Buddhist texts, and very few Sanskrit ones, have subsequently been found there. Those few that did survive have been taken out of ancient stupas in Nepal and Kashmir, or dug from the deserts of Afghanistan and Central Asia. Only the Theravadin teachings were written down in Sri Lanka, and thus escaped the obliteration of Buddhism in India, so that they have been preserved down to the present day in the form of the Pali Canon. When in the 19th century European scholars came upon this ancient work, there was no knowledge in the West of any other Buddhist canon to rival it. Thus, what we now know as the Pali Canon gained its status as the major source of the Buddha's teaching for modern scholars, through an accident of history, rather than as a reflection of its original status within the tradition as a whole. And the Pali Canon itself is a glorious mixture, a mishmash of mnemonic schemes organized for use in monastic instruction, reported sayings, additions and omissions by centuries of narrators. We can guess that the teachings as communicated by word of mouth had far more life and fluency than these written versions, which sometimes seem rather dry. Admittedly, the Pali Canon is our main source of early Buddhist teaching, But given what we now know about the history of the Sangha in India, we can no longer take it as the definitive record of the Buddha's dispensation. Such records as we have of the schools that grew and flourished on the Indian mainland at around the same time as the Theravada show a diversity of interpretation of the Buddha Vachana, the word of the Buddha, which is not to be found in the Pali Canon. In a text called the Mahavastu, for example, a very different spirit prevails. The Mahavastu belongs to the Vinaya of the Lokottaravada, an offshoot of the Mahasanghika school. It's a very early work, as early as many of the Pali scriptures, but although some of the material contained in it overlaps with the Pali canon, its joyful and poetic tone contrasts markedly with the atmosphere of austere composure of many of the Theravadin texts. The Mahavastu is ostensibly a book of monastic discipline, but unlike the Pali Vinaya, it contains practically no information on the rules of the order or their origin. It suggests a kind of Buddhism that emphasizes not codes, lectures, and prohibitions, but myths, stories, and celebrations of the heroic deeds of the great personalities of Buddhist history and legend. The exploits of the Buddhas of the past stand side by side with those of the Buddha Shakyamuni in his previous existences, stretching back into endless past aeons. In short, the Mahavastu gives a rather different impression of early Buddhism from that which we associate with the Pali Canon, indicating that significant sections of the early Buddhist Sangha continue to follow practices and propagate teachings that were not to find their way into the Theravadin canon, and that show marked, though at this stage relatively undeveloped, Mahayana characteristics. The Mahayana was evidently not just a movement of reaction to what it called the Hinayana. The Mahavastu alone reveals that the pre-Mahayana Buddhist scene was a far more diverse landscape than is commonly assumed. Early Buddhism, we can conclude, like the Mahayana later on, was more a broad spiritual movement than a particular school with a clear-cut scheme of doctrines and practices. Nonetheless, there was something of a transition, of course, from the first phase of Buddhist history to the second. And this is where we return to the theme of the khandhas. It could be said that the transition from mainstream Hinayana teaching into early Mahayana Buddhism turned upon the conception of shunyata, or the inherent emptiness of all phenomena. It was the shunyata doctrine that posed a direct challenge to the Hinayana's conception of dhammas as having some kind of ultimate nature. According to the Mahayana view, the belief in a plurality of ultimately existent dhammas is what prevented the Hinayana schools from entering into what might be called the deepest dimension of insight. It is a start to realize that the so-called personality is made up of subsidiary qualities, even of atoms or dhammas, but obviously it is no use if the start is regarded as the end of the story, if these dhammas are not themselves seen to be without inherent existence. The truth that the Mahayanists perceived was that not only could these supposedly indivisible elements be broken down into even smaller parts, but this process could logically be extended indefinitely, so that the whole idea of a plurality of ultimate dhammas was therefore inherently absurd. This provided a clue to the significance of the concept of shunyata. Viewed from the perspective of shunyata, any term or concept is an upaya, a means to an end, not a fixed entity or ultimate truth. However hard we try, we cannot analyze everything to a conclusion, not even if we call that conclusion emptiness. This is why we have to be very cautious about even trying to say anything about shunyata. However much the mind desires certainty, words can only take us so far. It has been said that intelligence consists in the creative use of concepts. One might say that this definition must include the awareness that concepts cannot encompass the whole of reality. The great sages of the Mahayana, such as Vasubandhu and Asanga, taught that the doctrine of Shunyata can only be perceived in a state in which all previous modes of thinking have been abandoned, and the very concepts and symbols introduced by the various schools of Buddhism are understood to be no more than provisional aids to the attainment of enlightenment. The doctrine of Shunyata does not remove the need for other Buddhist teachings, for provisional truths, or for examination of the nature of the self and the mind along the lines of the five khandhas, or the fuller analysis of the Abhidhamma. All it is meant to do is to remind us that the ultimate point of our practice is not to be found in the means we employ to realize it. The analysis of the 31 constituents, which, through the analogy of a bag of mixed grains, are said earlier in the sutta to make up the human body, can hardly be said to be adequate to the complexities of our physical condition. How much less adequate still is the doctrine of the five khandhas to the even greater complexities of the whole psychophysical organism. The five heaps are sometimes less specifically divided into two, rupa, or form, being one, and nama, comprising feeling, perception, volition, and consciousness, the other. When the Sarvastivadin Abhidhamma scholars set to work, though, they come up with a far more sophisticated and systematic schema. This was based on three main categories: rupa, citta, or mind, and cetasika dhammas, which is mental events, each of which they subdivided in various ways. But for all this elaboration, the Abhidhammists continued to base themselves on the same fundamental model. In the end, it was never a very imaginative exercise. Even though some of the analysis throws useful light on the workings of the mind, the real point was somehow lost along the way. It could not help giving the impression that the mind is finally nothing more than a very complicated machine made up of all manner of cogs and levers, pulleys and springs, which can be numbered and laid out in front of you in easily defined groups. Such an impression is really inevitable, however sophisticated your model. The problem is more in our own minds than in the models we use. We tend to take ideas literally, to take models of things for the things themselves, to take the picture of what is going on for what is going on. Even with an aspect of ourselves that is clearly observable, the physical body, the precise nature of its workings is almost impossible to envisage. We might abandon the static image of the bag filled with 31 kinds of grain, but if we analyse the body down into organs, glands, systems, and all the various kinds of tissue, it still seems that we cannot help thinking in terms of bits and pieces rather than interacting processes. In the same way, dhammas remain essentially components, and useful as they may be in identifying the nature of our mental states, they do not do justice to the way the psychophysical organism works as a whole, any more than do the five khandhas. If we cannot stay aware that the five khandhas are not separable components, but five sets of processes that are inextricably involved with one another, no amount of further analysis will make this any clearer. Historically, the five khandha classification is a very important teaching, and for this reason alone one cannot ignore it. As a Buddhist, one needs to be very familiar with the list of the khandhas, at least in English, and preferably in Pali as well. If the classification of the khandhas is fundamental to the Buddhist tradition, however, it may seem rather less so to contemporary Buddhist practice as a modern practical proposition. Although it may help to overturn the illusion of a fixed personality, it still gives no more than a hint of the way in which the many activities of consciousness are interrelated at any given moment. In short, the fivefold breakdown of our experience into form, feeling, perception, volition, and consciousness is not the only possible, or even necessarily the best, formulation of the principle that it is meant to convey. One might well decide that it is time to give the five khandhas and all the dhammas into which they were subsequently divided a well-earned retirement. It could even be said that some modern formulations might be better. One of the advantages of Freud's analysis of human experience, for example, is that it does explicitly take account of the essentially dynamic nature of the psyche. With some ancient Buddhist teachings, one might just about be able to see what they're getting at, but they need so much careful explanation that it might be more helpful to go back to the drawing board and try to reformulate the basic principle involved and come up with an entirely fresh way of bringing the principle home to people. A modern Abhidhamma might be able to make use of developments in psychology, neuroscience, and anatomy, for example. Whether or not such an analysis was ultimately judged to be adequate, it would be useful because it would make us look more carefully at what the Buddha was trying to convey through the doctrine of the five khandhas. It might even be, in the end, that for all our knowledge, the contemplation of the five khandhas would still prove to be the most effective practice to help us come to realize the conditioned, composite, dynamic, and insubstantial nature of things.